The content of this podcast should not be considered financial or investment advice. All interviews and discussions are opinions only, and the podcast has been created without taking into consideration the listener's financial objectives, financial situation, or needs. Listeners should obtain independent advice before making any financial decisions.
G'day, this is Barry Fitzgerald, Garen Perra columnist for Stockhead. Welcome to another edition of the Explorers Podcast. We're off to Canada today with a company called Trinex Minerals. ASX code is TX3, trading at the princely price of 0.4 of a cent, which Garen Perra always gets interested in these lightly capitalised explorers, particularly those that have some interesting projects that they're active on. In this case, it's lithium and uranium in Canada. Now, some existing shareholders in Trinex will remember when it was called Todd River, focus in base metals up in the Northern Territory. But a serious pivot here to the Northwest Territories of Canada, where there's an emerging lithium province, and then the Athabasca Basin in Saskatchewan, which is famous, of course, for the world's highest grade source of uranium. So with that, I'll introduce Will Dix. Will Dix is the Managing Director, and he's going to bring us up to speed on what the company's up to. G'day, Will. Welcome to the podcast.
Morning, Barry. Thanks for having me.
I mentioned the name change there, Will. Bit intrigued. What does Trinex mean?
Trinex was sort of a combination of a long discussion internally with rebranding Todd River Resources when we pivoted into Canada. And I guess it came about through the focus being lithium or becoming lithium and lithium being the third element on the periodic table. So the tri part of it is the three. So it was originally going to be Trinity Resources or Trinity Minerals, but I have a personal link to Trinity, having been a student at Trinity Grammar in Melbourne. So I sort of put the kibosh on that and we went for Trinex as a sort of abbreviation, I guess, of Trinity Exploration. With the three being the lithium link, I guess, in the name.
I always say companies become their names. Look at BHP. It's got nothing to do with Broken Hill, but it's still BHP, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Now, I forgot to mention they're very light capitalization, $7 million. So obviously lots of leverage to exploration success. In recent days, you've reported you've kicked some goals in the uranium space in the Athabasca Basin there. At Gibbons Creek, not far from a little town called Stony Rapids, which fortunately enough comes with its own airstrip, so nice access in that for that part of the world. What are you hoping to achieve in that part of the world on the uranium front?
Gibbons Creek's a new project for us. We only sort of scratched the surface of that, and we're currently in the process of putting together a definitive agreement whereby we have the right to earn up to 75%. We're operating under a binding letter of intent while that legal work is being done. But Gibbons Creek sits right on the northern edge of the Athabasca Basin. And, you know, as you mentioned, the Athabasca is world famous for high-grade uranium mineralization at places like Cigar Lake. And recently there's been a lot of exploration success with 92E at Gemini and other projects around the southern edge of the basin. So we had this opportunity come to us right at the start of the year. There is a little bit of historic drilling that's hit narrow intersections of really interesting uranium hits, you know, sub 1%, just under 1%. But one of the key things that we see with that is really strong boron mineralization or boron anomalism, and that's a key driver and a key vector for uranium exploration in the district. So that we thought that was interesting. And we've picked out three main target areas. The first one is ironically called Airstrip, for obvious reasons. It sits just off to the edge of the Stony Rapids community. We're drilling there at the moment. We're about halfway through a six or seven hole program to test a couple of areas where previous mineralization's been hit. So a lot of sort of smoke in the area, and we're trying to use some good geochemistry and some geophysics to vector into where we might have an accumulation of uranium mineralization. Away from airstrip, as you move southwest into the project, we have a couple of other target areas. The first one being called Butler Lake. That's a long sort of narrow corridor of EM conductors, and the EM conductors are important because they reflect an accumulation of graphite in the Athabasca, and where you have the graphite, you have potential to have a redox reaction to drop out the uranium mineralization. So we've got EM conductors over several kilometres through the Butler Lake prospect. There's a couple of old holes there that, again, have hit anomalous uranium, anomalous thorium, some interesting potassium mineralization in there as well. So we are pretty excited about Butler Lake. It's an area that we will drill during the Canadian summer. So, July, August, September, that's that sort of timeline for the drilling there. And thirdly, at Gibbons Creek in the far southwest of the corner of the project, we have an area called Hocking West. Hocking West is interesting in that the traditional thinking down there is that it's quite deep, and the basin does rapidly the depth to basement in the basin rapidly becomes quite extensive as you move towards the middle of the basin, and the old school thinking at Hocking West is that it's probably deeper than 500 meters to basement. But some of the recent work that we've looked at and some of the geophysics work we've looked at suggests that there is a basement high just to the south of us. And given that we've got some easily discernible airborne EM conductors at Hocking West, the sort of logic says that, well, if it was 500-600 meters deep at that point, you're not going to see any EM conductors in the airborne survey. It's not possible for it to see that deep. So we're thinking, given what we've seen, that it is likely to be either a faulted block or a natural basin high that lets you see the EM conductors. And we see them both in the airborne and some old ground EM data quite clearly. And they look really good, exactly what you like to see. There's breaks in them, which potentially is where you get the destruction of the graphite and sort of clay over prints, which is what you want. So we'll do a little bit more geophysics there, just tighten that up. And really try to get a good feel for the depth to basement. We're even considering things like some passive seismic just to tie that down before we put a drill hole into it. But again, similarly to Butler Lake, I would like to think that we'll put a couple of holes into Hocking West in the coming Canadian summer as well. So, we will have a fairly aggressive exploration program there for the next month or so, with finishing off airstrip. But also through the middle of the year with the summer campaign that'll happen in Gibbons Creek.
Now, you've mentioned there's some historical work there. I'm just wondering, have you picked up, and you're obviously applying modern geophysical techniques now, is there much difference? Does it light up things that weren't seen back in the previous exploration periods?
Yeah, certainly. The technology is moving all the time. I mean, the actual way of gathering the data is not dissimilar in terms of, you either fly a helicopter or fixed-wing aircraft, or you can put loops on the ground per EM and cover it with a number of stations per day on the ground. But what improves is the depths that you can see down to. So as the transmitters become more powerful, receivers become more susceptible to more subtle variations, you actually get better quality data. And some of the subtleties with removing noise from your data set and cleaning up the signal is really what makes the difference these days. So you can compare a survey done, say, in the mid-90s or in the early 2000s with a survey that you do today. And we'll see, staggeringly more defined image, which again lets you focus in much more quickly onto key areas and do follow-up work in a smaller area that might be, say, a 400 by 400 meter window, rather than having to sort of only be able to narrow down to a kilometer. So things get much, much more effective, and it lets you explore more efficiently, which, when you're spending shareholders' money, you want to be as effective as efficient as you possibly can be. So all of those little all of those little benefits that you get with improving technology help you be better explorers. One of the things I say to everyone, Barry, is, you know, we can't change the geology. If there's nothing there, we can't find it. But we try to be as effective and as efficient as we can to maximize the amount of money that we can put into the ground.
You had that track record when the Mount Hardy in Northern Territory was the focus, where you ended up with the resource. But obviously, I think there's bigger prizes to be had here in Canada. Now, just tell me, what's Stormy Rapids like as a town?
Pretty small. I don't even think it's got town status in Saskatchewan, to be honest. I think it's called the community of Stony Rapids. So, there's an airstrip that services some Indigenous communities in the area. There's a general store and a place to stay. And, I'd hate to sell it short because it's a beautiful part of the world up there. But, you know, it might not be the sort of place that people that live in Vancouver go for a holiday.
Let's pivot over to the lithium in the Northwest Territories, just beneath the Arctic Circle there, north of Yellowknife, which I think is about 400 k south of the Arctic Circle. Interesting part of the world, and it seems that there's a bit of an emerging lithium province there. We've all heard about James Bay, region of Canada, but this Northwest Territories, few companies active there, and you've managed to pick up a number of interesting projects. So what's the story there?
Yeah, you're spot on. Absolutely, it's a really emerging lithium province. There's a number of companies that have got decent land positions there. We're one of them. There's significant amount of spodumene that's already been identified, and we have three projects there, two of which we have got spodumene in pegmatites. We haven't done any drilling there at this stage. We're still in the permitting process for that, but I think one of the really interesting things with hard rock spodumene and James Bay is further down the road, absolutely, than the Northwest Territories are. But really, there's a bit of a race on, and the race is not so much between James Bay and Northwest Territories. It's really between the hard rock spodumene producers and the brine guys in South America and Central America. And I think for the Northwest Territories, there's really a window of opportunity for them to become a significant player in the hard rock spodumene space. There's a strong willingness from government in Yellowknife to facilitate as much as they can in terms of getting the show on the road. Couple of companies are a little bit ahead of us. Lift Power, who are TSXV listed, they are well down the road of drilling out a number of pegmatites. They have a resource, or they have they are about to have a resource if it's not out already. You have Loyal Lithium, a fellow ASX listed company who are in the district. They've got a project called Hidden Lake, which has also got quite a bit of historic drilling on it. So there is an understanding in the Northwest Territories that in order to really get to the front of the queue along with James Bay in Canada, that these projects need to start to see the light of day. We are lucky enough to have a very good land position north of Yellowknife at a place called Halo-Urey, where we've got 350 square kilometres. We're going to get stuck in over the Canadian summer up there with all of the sort of phase one work, if you like, which is effectively mapping, sampling, trekking across the ground, looking undercover as best we can, but certainly sampling all of the pegmatites that outcrop. And we can see them in satellite imagery. You know, we can see that we've got pegmatites that are of significant scale. You know, you're talking 1.5-2 kilometer long, hundreds of meters wide pegmatites that stick their noses out of the ground at various places, and we'll be testing all of those and going and having a look at those over the summer, because I think where we are geographically and logistically, you're going to have scale. So in order for something to get up and running in this part of the world, you need 50 million tons plus, and you probably need more than that even. What's really interesting on a broader Northwest Territories scale is that some of the big guys are in town now. So Fortescue, for instance, have pegged an enormous amount of ground around both our Halo Yuri project and also around our Mac project, which is also just north of Yellowknife. So they are really keen on the area. They're really keen on the district. And there's an awareness that following on from James Bay in terms of, you know, the market darling for lithium, Northwest Territory is a really good chance to be the next cab off the rank because there is, you know, a significant amount of potential in the Great Slave geological province, which are where these pegmatites are found. We're really excited about our lithium position there.
Now, you're going to have plenty of daylight hours during the summer campaign. I can remember being in Yellowknife and staggering out of the pub at 1 a.m. in the morning, and it was broad daylight. So I'm just wondering, the access to your, well, Mac is, I think they're all pretty much all just off the winter roads up there. But what is access like for you in that part of the world to get to the projects?
Yeah, it's a gulch. You know, there's no shying away from that. So for Ross Lake and Mac, we will commute in and out from Yellowknife by helicopter. Ross Lake's only about 20 minutes in a chopper. Mac's probably about 30. Taylor Yuri will actually utilise an existing camp that's up there as part of the sort of regional diamond exploration business that's been going on up in the northern part of the NWT for a number of decades. So we'll have access to a camp there. And it's very, very different from WA and from Australia, because one of the ways they explore is that they will use a boat on the lakes to travel around the edges of the lake and you know, obviously use a GPS to work out where to stop. And they jump out of the boat and go and run around and take a bunch of samples from pegmatites, come back down, back in the boat, off to the next stop and do it all again. So It sounds a bit crazy from an Australian exploration point of view, but you know, the guys that are helping us out on the ground there, it's their bread and butter.
Best way to get around.
And one of the benefits of having so much daylight and having such a water rich environment is that, you know, you knock off for the day, maybe go and have some dinner, and then you can jump back in the boat with your fishing rods and go and catch some northern pike or some late trout. You know, between 7 p.m. and 11 p.m. and like you said, it's broad daylight. So it's a great work-life balance for guys that are out in the field.
And those diamond mines you were talking about, Ekati and Diavik, Ekati was a BHP diamond mine for a long time. Diavik, Rio Tinto, I think, right up near your Halo Yuri project.
One of the things that is, and I mentioned the Northwest Territories government being, you know, very supportive and pushing like crazy to streamline everything for lithium. They are very aware that the diamond mines are closer to the end of their life than the start of their life. And you know, they're funded by a per capita. The Northwest Territories government is funded by a per capita of people living in the territory. And if the diamond mines close and there's no replacement workforce or workplace for the miners, then they're going to lose a lot of people out of the NWT, and obviously they don't want to see that happen. So, you know, it's another part of the opportunity for lithium in that there's a workforce that's ready and waiting. They're well utilized at the moment, but that's not going to last forever. So, it's an interesting situation up there.
Canada, apart from the prospectivity, both for uranium, obviously, and we're talking lithium now. I was just wondering whether your pivot towards Canada had a lot to do with, obviously, the WA scene's very crowded, but the US IRA, did you see that? Did that factor in your decision-making?
Well, not really. I mean, when we started looking at critical minerals and wanting to get into that space, we looked at a number of projects all around the world, you know, South America, you know, parts of Africa and parts of Canada. And one of the things that really led us down the road of doing something in Canada is the opportunity to work with the DeRouge Group. They're our largest shareholder at around 14%. And you know, Jody DeRouge has got an extremely good team of geoscientists that work for him, all of which have got uranium and lithium experience across Canada and through the US. So having the access to a really strong technical team in country, for us being a long way away, it gives us a level of comfort that things are going to be done properly and things are going to be done to best practice. And if we run into any problems, you know, there's a big team of guys working under the Darouche banner that are available to help us out. Whereas other areas we looked at in other jurisdictions, we would have had to, you know, reinvent the wheel from scratch, if you like, and set up ourselves. So being able to move into a country and an area and projects that had a team bolted onto them, that was a really attractive reason for us to get in there.
I've heard him referred to as Canada's version of Mark Creasy. Is that a good summary?
That's not far from the truth, I guess. Jody's, you know, he's a really clever guy who's got lots of fingers in lots of pies, and he runs an incredible incubating company whereby he and his team identify opportunities in various commodities and then either work them up themselves and explore them themselves, or look for listed vehicles to put them into. I guess one of his more recent, high profile successes is that, Jody was the vendor behind the Corvette project that's really put Patriot Battery Metals on the map. So, he's got a bunch of guys working for them. He's also heavily involved in Q2 Metals, in Loyal Lithium with us, and a number of other projects and companies as well. So, he works really hard, and I speak to him regularly, and he, he's always available for a bit of advice or an idea. So it's great to have him on board.
And I see, looking at the register here, that under 5% or thereabouts, you also have S2R, which is Mark Bennett of Nova Bollinger phone, on the register.
Yeah, so Mark and I go back a long, long way to the late 90s, where we worked together, or I worked for Mark at Lionel, a Canadian company that was taken over by Norilsk back in the day. And then Mark and I have worked on various things together over the last 20-odd years. And actually, Mark was involved with us, or became involved with us, on the back of some of the early work at Mount Hardy, that we were drilling sick intersections of base metals that were really exciting. But, unfortunately, we couldn't get the scale to a point where it was big enough to have a standalone operation. I think we've got about 2.6 million tonnes at 11% zinc equivalent. It's like the Mount Hardy itself, the Hendrix resource is open, but needs a big brother to come in and spend some money there. Mark and his guys have been involved since the end of 2018, still on the register. Mark is no longer on our board due to other priorities for him. And, we shared an office with the S2 guys for a number of years, and there's still a lot of communication between us, both professionally and personally. We're good friends as well as former colleagues.
So let's bring it all together, Will, and give investors an idea of what they should be looking out for, say, in the next 12 months.
I guess the short term is really the Gibbons Creek drilling that we're halfway through. We're drilling at Airstrip. We've put out an announcement early this week that just reinforces the fact that there's a lot of smoke in the district, and we're looking for where that accumulation might be. As we move through the year, we're working through the permitting for drilling in the Northwest Territories. We're doing our First Nations engagement work. We've almost finished that. We've done most of it. There's a couple of other boxes to tick, but we'll put in our land use permit applications to enable us to drill in the next month. So that'll happen. Coming into summer, it'll be a really strong push on both the first phase field work at Halo Yuri in the northern part of the Northwest Territories on the lithium front, but also on the uranium front. We'll look to tighten up the geophysics around Butler Lake and Hocking West. We will look to get on the ground with drilling in the middle of the year. We're fully permitted to drill in Saskatchewan. We're funded, we've got over $4 million in the bank. So we're actually in a really good position to pursue our exploration priorities over the next 6 to 12 months.
So there we go, folks, a very interesting uranium and lithium in Canada. Two very smart shareholders on the register there, and plenty of action to come in the next 12 months. So, Will, thanks for your time today. Love the story. Good luck with it all. We'll be watching with interest.
Thanks, Barry. Great to be on. Appreciate your time.
Cheers.